Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Susan Spicer is one busy woman. While running two successful restaurants, Biona and Mondo, somehow Susan found time to serve as consultant on the HBO series Treme. Susan's here with the scoop on season 3. And speaking of busy chefs, Monroe's Corey Barr is making big news in North Louisiana with his game-changing restaurant Cotton. And Corey also won the big prize on this season's Food Network show, Chopped. Hi Hat Cafe's Chip Epperson and Chef Jeremy Walgamott felt like they'd won the big prize when a coterie of New York's top chefs showed up at their Ferret Street Eatery for a casual Sunday supper. We'll get the details on their big night and celebrate a culinary heritage hero too, all on this week's Louisiana Eats. Chef Susan Spicer has been a vital part of the New Orleans restaurant scene since her 1979 apprenticeship with Chef Daniel Bonneau at Louis XVI. For 22 years, Susan's creativity has kept her French Quarter restaurant, Bayona, in the top 10 of everyone's favorite list. And in 2010, she helped revive the Lakeview restaurant scene with the opening of Mondo. Somehow, this busy woman has also found the time to serve as chef consultant on the HBO series Treme. Susan, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks, Poppy.
Susan, I'd like you to tell us the story of how David Simon came to choose you as the model for his fictional New Orleans chef, Jeanette Desitel.
Well, I think he was introduced to my restaurant, Biona, through a mutual friend. And so I actually met him once or twice at the restaurant. I never did really ask him how it came about, but I'm assuming it's fairly obvious that they were going to have a chef character. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have a story about New Orleans without restaurants being in the mix. So it was always just my thought that he might have thought it was more interesting to make that character a woman.
Yeah, there's something funny when I see Jeanette on the screen. I'd like to know how you felt when you were introduced to her, this woman who was in essence about to be your sort of doppelganger.
Well, I think she is just somebody like me who is very, maybe very passionate about what she does. And I like Kim. I think she's got that kind of street savvy essence about her, which I thought was really good for the character. She caught on very quickly to the feeling in the kitchen. And the, you know, one of the things that I had to communicate to her was just the level of intensity and urgency. You know, that's kind of the essence of what goes on in a restaurant kitchen. You know, that's a real term. I think Thomas Keller has it written over the clock of his kitchen at Per Se in New York, you know, and it's urgency, you know, and it's just time is of the essence and you got to do it quickly and with great focus. So that was kind of something I had to convey to her that she picked up on rather quickly.
And in those early days that you were doing this consulting work, how did you do that? How did you get her to feel? Did she come in and observe?
She came in and hung out at the Biona kitchen as well as the sous chef character. So they both came in at different times. And, you know, I taught her some knife skills. But yeah, she would stand and watch. And I think she spent 3 or 4 different times in the kitchen. Other than that, you know, it was fairly easy duty. I did work on a menu for the restaurant, and that was a lot of fun. They are so focused on detail. I had to kind of find out what the time of the year so that the menu reflected. You know, I had to think back, you know, what was available in New Orleans, you know, what produce, you know, I mean, it took the farmers markets and the farmers a while to get back together, what was available, what was around, who were the purveyors, and that sort of thing. So it was really fun.
Were you called on at any time to do any hands-on script work, like things that maybe were realistic or were not realistic?
Definitely. That's one of the most fun things about the job, you know, job in air quotes. It's pretty easy. Was that I get to read the scripts in advance and I get to put my two cents in. And I try to limit it to the kitchen scenes, the areas of my expertise, although there are some times where I have opinions about other things.
So can you give me a specific example of when you piped in with your two cents?
Oh, yes. I did that several times. And they listened to a lot of them and accepted what I had to say. But there was one time that I felt pretty strongly about something that they didn't change. And that was, I believe it was at Le Bernardin. When she was on the cell phone
in the kitchen.
And I really, I know that I'm from a different generation, but having been a chef herself, I thought it was surprising that she would do that, that she would try to speak on her cell phone during. I felt like she should be more respectful.
Not during dinner service.
It was during, may not have been in the middle of service, but I think it kind of was. It was either that or in the middle of prep. But be that as it may, I didn't feel like that was something that she should do. They didn't change it because I think that was when her friend was calling her to tell her about Mardi Gras and all that sort of thing.
It was a really important call.
It was a very important call. Right.
Let's go back to season two, because on season two, then suddenly there you are.
That's right. You see? She's not me. I'm me.
You're you. And so you're there playing yourself on the show.
Oh, my gosh.
How did that come about?
They just asked me if I would want to do a scene, and I would jump at the chance. My main goal was to keep from looking like a total idiot, and Kim made it really easy. Where the scene was, we're walking down Canal Street heading towards the streetcar. I really felt like I was talking to Jeanette. She made it very easy to get into the part and the character.
And you all would have established a rapport
at that point.
By that point.
Sure. So it was great, but a little nerve-wracking.
I loved
trying
it.
To just be nervous. My husband said I did a really good job until my last line. So then he...
Well, my favorite part of it, what I really loved, and I can still see it in my mind, I loved that image of you riding the streetcar, looking like you were almost taking a nap in that warm sunshine. And it just came across as exactly that sort of moment that we were all trying to steal for ourselves in those early post-Katrina days when the streetcar finally started running again. And how did reenacting those kind of post-storm moments make you feel? And were you really as comfortable on that streetcar as you looked?
I was very comfortable, but I have to say, I hadn't taken the streetcar for probably 10 years. And I'll tell you what, after that filming that scene, I'm good for about another 10 years because we rode that thing around about 40 times that day.
Yeah.
So I definitely got my streetcar dose for a couple of years. No, it was great. First of all, it was a beautiful, beautiful day in May. It was one of the last cool days that we had before summer descended on us. And we spent the entire day outside because we did keep getting on and off the streetcar and riding the streetcar from Canal to Howard Avenue around and around. And of course, I was watching Janet emoting, silently. It was, and she was getting all teary. And it was really a fun experience. And I did enjoy writing it, at least the first 15 times.
The first 15 times. Well, so tell me, what's coming next in Susan Spicer's world?
Well, that's a really good question. I've been kind of toying with the idea of maybe a Mondo cookbook.
Ooh.
That might be a fun
That would be
project.
So fun.
Yeah. Well, I actually finished the manuscript for the first one in May, right before Katrina. So that's why it didn't come out till 2007. But, it's been 7 years. I have lots of new recipes and lots more things that I could include in a cookbook, more experiences, more recipes. And I think that might be something I'd like to concentrate on for a while. Probably no new restaurants. I think New Orleans is doing pretty good in the restaurant department now.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Every time you turn around.
But there's a lot of good ones out there.
Well, thank you so much for coming to give us a little look back and look forward at everybody's favorite HBO Treme.
Here's to season four.
Here's to season four. Bring it on, for God's sake.
Bring it on, I know. Of course, we got to see season three first.
I can't wait. Susan Spicer, chef, restaurateur, and food consultant on the HBO series Treme. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is a wild man of the swamps. He's known at Louisiana's farmers markets for his wild Bayou des Hommes catfish, but in September, our hero can be found trapping alligators in the swamps and bayous.
Once we're satisfied with the placement of the bait, we'll exit the scene, drift off into another area, set another one. We're going to do this 35 or 40 times, depending upon how many tags we're going to fill and how fast we want to fill them. If we're skinning alligators, which is what I've been doing the last 25 or 30 years, every year, something like that, I try to regulate myself to about 2-3 alligators a day. It would be okay if I'd catch all 6- and 7-footers. Every once in a while, you get these little 4-footers, and every once in a while, you get the other ones that are 6 and 7 plus 4.
Between 1938 and 1958, Louisiana had lost more than 90% of the native reptile due to over-harvesting by eager hunters who made profits from sales of the hide. Alligator hunting was banned in Louisiana in 1961, and in 1967, the federal government put alligators on the endangered species list, affording them full protection. Left alone, the gator population rebounded quickly, and by 1981, an official alligator season was reinstated in Louisiana. Our culinary heritage hero has great respect for the alligator, right down to the way he harvests them.
First, I talked to him. Couldn't get along without it. If he has to meet his maker, let's be polite about it. We're going to flip him in the boat as soon as we rake him from the floton. We tagged him because immediately upon taking, you tagged the animal. Now we can rock and roll to the next line. Depending upon what's happening, we take him straight to the cooler. Cool him down for 6, 8, 10, 12 hours. Like I am right now with the cooler broken. I've already had to lay them down in a pirogue and cover them with ice and water. Not long after, the animal stiffens up a little bit, and it makes it easier to skin.
In a very sustainable fashion, he makes use of every part of the gator, not only selling the hide, but also the gator's meat from the very best bits. That's why Joey Fonseca is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. 'Tis the season for alligator, so celebrate with a taste of our state's most delectable reptile soon. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Joey Fonseca's alligator is authentic Louisiana Eats. Return from a short break, we travel to Monroe for a visit with Cotton Restaurant's award-winning chef, Corey Barr. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name of the Louisiana mandarin orange likely to be in short supply this season because of Hurricane Isaac, is the Satsuma. Thought to have originated in Japan sometime around 1600 AD, the Satsuma has been a Louisiana staple since the mid-1800s. With its leathery, easy-to-peel skin and sweet pull-apart sections, it's a lunchbox favorite and a perfect carry-along treat. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, this past week, several contestants sent in their answers with condolences to the Louisiana Satsuma. I know I'll certainly miss them as a garnish for salads and a puree for margaritas. I just hope Colette Thomas of Baton Rouge thinks coffee is an acceptable substitute for Satsumas, because she's this week's winner. Congratulations to you, Colette, and thanks to everyone out there who participated.
Our lucky winner will be receiving three full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the cooking mistake that results in that greenish-gray ring around the yellow yolk of a hard-boiled egg? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the cooking mistake that results in a greenish-gray ring around the yellow yolk of a hard-boiled egg? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Corey Barr, one of Louisiana's hottest young chefs, hails from Monroe, Louisiana. He's changing the way North Louisiana food is regarded and becoming quite a national superstar along the way. Corey, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hey, Poppy. I'm so happy to be here.
Let's just start at the very start. How did your life in food begin?
My life in food began as a child, really. My grandparents, they raised me in North Louisiana, you know, and they were always cooking. Their parents were always cooking. They were always cooking. We were always doing something in the kitchen, and, you know, that's where the family spent most of the time.
And your professional life began?
My professional life began actually, believe it or not, in the front of the house as a waiter. And, you know, I migrated to the back, and that's where it all started.
Oh, I've done a little research, Corey, and I would really like to know.
You got some skeletons? What are we?
Well, I do. I do personally. So I've been digging for years, buddy. So what happened when you were 16?
My grandmother was diagnosed with lymphoma, and I had to move with my dad, and you know, that was kind of a life changing scenario right there.
And so you quit school?
Yeah, I quit school and found a life in the service industry. So that was really a blessing in disguise. My grandmother went into remission, has been so ever since, and still alive and kicking, and just an awesome inspiration still to this day.
Well, I'm particularly fascinated by the fact that you jumped into the food industry at the age of 16, and as far as I can tell, you don't have any culinary school background?
No, actually, I didn't really get to stage with any known chefs until after I'd kind of, I guess you'd say, made a little name for myself. So all of my technique is self-taught, and I was highly motivated to learn food. And some of my earliest memories of, like, seeing before Food Network or anything like that were, you know, great chefs of the world came on LPB. We had three channels in Lake Providence, Louisiana, you know, and LPB was one of them, and that's typically what we were watching. So, you know, I was just fascinated by not only the show itself, but the MC's voice and how her enunciation of words and how well she spoke, and it was a really awesome show to watch, you know.
When you were coming up as a young chef, you did a lot of traveling. You were around and about.
I did, but I didn't. I did a lot of traveling when I was young and in the service industry, but I didn't do the fancy traveling. I never went to France for 6 months and worked for Joël Robuchon or the Trois Gros brothers or anything like that. But you know, I did a lot of traveling in the South and also a little bit in Texas, kind of from Atlanta, a little bit in New Orleans, and then San Antonio in that area.
Anybody in particular influence your food?
I mean, to be honest with you, not really. I mean, my food kind of hails from where I'm from. A lot of what I did was read cookbooks by people I really admired and have since had the pleasure to meet and hang out with and share a few cocktails with.
But, like who?
You know, we've got Frank Stitt in Birmingham, obviously Susan Spicer here in New Orleans, but also some of the old ones. I mean, we go back to even some of our local cookbooks in my area, like Cotton Country Collection and things like that. They're just so cool. You know, Thomas Keller for technique, people like that. But really, it all started off just, like I said, blood and guts and work your butt off. You know, that's how it came about. And just dedication, hard work, and persistence. And that's really what's paid off for me in the long run.
That's the story of the restaurant business,
it,
huh?
It is. I mean, there's no other way to do it. You know, you're fortunate enough to have guests walking through your door with high expectations, and you better succeed or they're not going to come back. And we try to exceed guest expectations in my restaurant on a daily basis. We're not always successful, but more so than not. And we're working at it every day.
Well, I think that your story is very pertinent and really important to young people who are interested
in
this business.
Yeah, you know, Louisiana is known for its food and its hospitality. And the service industry in Louisiana thrives like no other in the country, in my opinion. I mean, I've had the opportunity to travel quite a bit. And man, home is just where it's at as far as food and service go. And we're going to start working on that in my part of the state to have more hospitality and culinary training programs throughout the state. We already have some great ones, you know, Delgado and obviously John Folse's Nickel State and everything. But more small communities, I think, could benefit from that, where maybe there's not as many outlets for the young people. And you know, because school's not for everybody. I mean, I hate to say that, you know,
yeah.
But it's some people are more tactile learners or hands-on, and the action of the service industry and the energy of it can attract some people who are maybe not as book-focused, I guess you would say.
A lot of times I get these questions from kids who are either graduating from high school or they've gotten a bachelor's degree, and all of a sudden they think the answer to their lives is the Culinary Institute.
Right. I have some kids now that are coming through. I have the benefit of having some stagiaires, some interns out of a ProStart program locally in my city. And I don't try to steer them away from culinary school, because I think some people, that benefits some people. But other people, I think it's more intelligent maybe to go and work for the best chefs you can and have hands-on training, because that real-world experience is where it's at. You know, kind of like going to med school. You learn a lot from the books. It's kind of like reading cookbooks. But until you put your hands on a patient, or until you put your hands on that subprimal part of a pig or something like that, you know, you just don't know. And Louisiana has so many great restaurants and so many wonderful chefs that are open to those sort of things, bringing in the next generation, if you will, to kind of take the torch and run with it.
You have described the style of cooking that you do as creative Southern cuisine. Tell us what that means.
Well, yeah, it's taking like heritage foods that I grew up with, my family cooked, that were locally available, and kind of reinventing them. We have some wonderful local farmers that we're using that are just, they're the inspiration for what we do now. And that's actually been only in the last few months that we've actually got some local people on board, which is so nice. But we just take things, you know, your typical North Delta food, really, your squash, your root veg, greens, things like that, and just twist them a little bit. You know, we use a lot of techniques, like my grandmother, for instance, always put vinegar in her water when she cooked her greens. You know, you don't see that in a cookbook anywhere, but it's how you bring those things along and how you cook your peppers in with it and everything else. It's just those are what we're using, those old kind of heritage techniques.
Just dissect for me one dish that our listeners might be familiar with that you have morphed into your new way.
Well, like some of the things that we're doing, like we do fried okra at the restaurant, but and you know, fried okra and ketchup go together great. But we actually we're making a ketchup that's based on one of my great grandmother's sort of recipes for a tomato condiment, if you will, mm-hmm. That is similar to ketchup, but it has, you know, molasses and things like that. And really, 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 really neat recipe. But with the okra, we're actually taking local okra and pickling it, and then cornmeal tempura frying it.
Ooh.
So it's just simple stuff like that. We're not really trying to reinvent the wheel. We're just taking great Southern food and turning it just a little bit.
Your reign as Louisiana King of Seafood is about to come to an end. So tell us, how was that experience?
Well,
and how has it perhaps affected your menu?
The experience of being King of Louisiana Seafood has been and was absolutely excellent. I mean, it gave me the ability to go out across the country and into Canada and speak to people about Louisiana seafood and what we do well in this state. You know, and to expose people to our products, to our cooking, to our hospitality. Got to go to Aspen for the Aspen Food and Wine, the 30th anniversary one. It was awesome. Got to meet some of my idols. I really don't get too starstruck, but when I met Jacques Pepin, I was pretty excited.
Well, I was going to talk to you about that because, you know, I follow you on Twitter, you know, I keep an eye out for you.
Yeah, social media, man, it's a game changer, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And so I knew that you had gone to the Aspen Food and Wine Festival, but I didn't know that you'd gone with your crown, so to speak.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about your experience there.
Well, we were there for the Grand Tastings, the Louisiana Seafood Promotion Marketing Board and myself. We're there for the Grand Tastings. We served wild Louisiana shrimp and also a black drum dish, but little North Delta style with our locally milled grits and collard greens. It's pretty good stuff. They seem to really enjoy it, but seeing all those faces, when you're in Aspen and you see these people and they see the Louisiana Seafood banner and they see those shrimp or they see that fish and they're just so excited, man, that just makes your job really easy, you know?
That's great. So you feel like across the country from the national chefs, you're seeing a positive response.
Absolutely. I feel like we're seeing a positive response. You know, when we met with some chefs, they're very interested in Louisiana seafood, and a lot of them are already menuing it in some form or another. And a lot of what the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board does is education. You know, it's educating people about the safety, the quality, the traceability of our seafood.
You've got some sort of special certification or something at Cotton, your restaurant, in regards to seafood.
Actually, they're working on it. We don't. That's not all the way through yet. But mm-hmm. what that is it's going to be a Louisiana seafood restaurant certification, basically where restaurants open their books and prove that they're buying Louisiana seafood. And that kind of puts the onus on the other restaurants in the area that aren't doing that, and then hopefully will make the guest ask a question, why are you not supporting local? Why are you not supporting local fishermen, local economy, local jobs? I mean, what's the problem?
Let's talk about your restaurant, Cotton.
Sure.
Why'd you call it Cotton?
You know, cotton is a huge part of where we're from. We're in the western part of the North Delta. Huge cotton farms all around. And the building itself is from the 1890s. It was cotton storage on the top floor of the building. So it just made sense. It's part of where we're from.
And what makes Cotton unique and special to the dining scene up there?
Well, Cotton uses all local, as local as we can get with the rest of our ingredients and all Louisiana seafood, and we just get out of the food's way. We use our traditional Southern techniques to really enhance what we've already got and just get out of its way and let it do its thing.
I think that you're pretty much blazing the way for craft cocktails up in the Monroe area,
We are, and again, we're not really reinventing the wheel with it. We're just taking old recipes and putting them in the public eye again. and people are finding a new appreciation for maybe underappreciated liquors and preparations, which is really exciting to see. And we are doing some cool things like our old fashioned. We kind of do a little differently, and we smoke it with cherry wood. And it makes for a great presentation and also adds a lot of character to the drink.
That sounds pretty yummy.
It's pretty tasty.
And I've seen the still photographs. I want to see it in action.
Yeah, it's kind of like sitting around the campfire, you know, drinking a little whiskey, which has been known to be done from time to time.
Really? Corey, recently you appeared on the Food Network show Chopped. And by the way, you won.
I won.
What was the biggest surprise that you got there?
I don't know if you'd call it a surprise or a gift, but I think the biggest gift I got on the show was the fish in the second round, the striped bass. That was pretty cool. But also, you know, the baskets themselves were just wild. I mean, with the combination of ingredients, I thought were really, really good.
And what was the hardest part?
The hardest part was, I would say, the time clock, you know, having to prepare well-composed dishes in that time frame. But we do it every day in the restaurant. You know, I think the biggest thing you have to contend with is being confident in your technique and just executing. I think that's you're your own biggest enemy in that show, I believe.
So, Corey, what comes next?
We've got a lot of cool things coming down. I'm working with a great lady right now, really working on focusing on the restaurant, growing the restaurant, and our community. We're working on a community garden now in Monroe, which we're working on plans for that.
Where is it in Monroe?
We're working on the location with the local government, and there's also some money being pledged by local businesses, which they're getting behind, which is awesome. And that's really what we're working on right now. Hopefully in the spring, I'll be opening my second location. Won't be another Cotton, but it's going to be a Northern Italian restaurant. But we're going to twist it a little bit to make it have some Southern flair, you know?
Well, you're making me hungry for a visit to Monroe.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you, Poppy.
Corey Barr of Monroe's Cotton Restaurant. Don't go anywhere. Rambling reporter Ian McNulty's here talking Southwest Louisiana smoked meat. We'll be right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Journalist, public radio contributor, and author of Louisiana Rambles, Ian McNulty is always hunting down a new, obscure, but delicious spot for rambling. Ian, where are we rambling to today?
Well, Poppy, today we're taking a little trip to Lafayette to check out a place I just discovered recently, but has quickly grown near and dear to my heart and, more importantly, to my belly.
Oh, yes, and what is that?
Okay, this place is called Johnson's Boucanière. Now, boucanière, some people out there already know, I'm sure, is the Acadian word for smokehouse. And that is exactly what it is. This is basically Johnson's Smokehouse. And it's a traditional butcher shop smokehouse in Lafayette, working with these Cajun traditions. But it has a really interesting backstory to it. It's a fairly new place. It opened in 2008. But like a lot of interesting good things in Louisiana, its roots really go back a bit.
Really? How far?
So back to 1937, when a place called Johnson's Grocery opened up in Eunice, a great town for Cajun music, Cajun culture.
And Cajun meat.
And Cajun meat, absolutely. Well, Johnson's Grocery was a little dry goods place when it first opened, but it evolved over the generations into like one of the real go-to places in the Cajun Prairie for boudin, of course, our favorite rice and pork sausage there in the links. You know, the Cajun breakfast, the Cajun lunch, the Cajun dinner, the Cajun snack, the Cajun everything, boudin. Well, sadly, to a lot of people, Johnson's Grocery closed in 2005 after, you know, a really long run of decades and decades and decades. But a few years later, another generation of the family just got the itch to get back into the business and really to reignite these old family recipes that were so popular there for so long. And they opened Johnson's Boucanière. Now, this is in Lafayette. It's not in Eunice. But if you were familiar with Johnson's Grocery's boudin and you taste what they're doing now at Johnson's Boucanière, same thing. It's same recipe, that same just really good snap to the link and just meaty links of boudin. They're peppery, but really more about savory seasoning than like spicy, spicy hot boudin. Really, to me, like one of the best links of boudin out there.
And what else do you get there besides boudin?
Well, this is a great place. I mean, the boucanière part, of course, the smokehouse, can mean a lot of different things in Cajun country. Here, in addition to boudin, it's really about barbecue, you know.
Barbecue?
This, yeah, it really functions as a Cajun barbecue restaurant. So you got a lot of smoked sausage there, of course, tasso, but also ribs and pork roasts and brisket, all just, you know, done with a little more spice and zing. Now, when you find this place, and I should say it's just on the edge of downtown Lafayette, just outside of the business district there, and not too far from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, it looks from the outside like a little grocery store, you know, and it's kind of packed inside with all sorts of clutter and stuff and little signs to read everywhere. And you can go in and get a pound of this or a pound of that. But you can also eat in, and they have all kinds of sandwiches and plate lunches. And everyone eats kind of outside on this kind of wraparound patio deck that really kind of looks like more modern and contemporary. So it's sort of this interesting mashup of the old and the new at this place. And they're also, in addition to their food, they're really about music. They're really into promoting local music. You'll see CDs from local Cajun and Zydeco artists all over the walls, and that Lafayette roots music that's really coming back so strong. And you'll probably see a few musicians that you might recognize from the local festival circuit chowing down there as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So what are they eating, you know, besides the boudin? They have things like the Parent Special, which is basically their idea of a Cajun grilled cheese with a fried boudin ball smashed, covered in barbecue sauce, American cheese, all on an Evangeline-made bun. Evangeline-made being the kind of the big, like almost the big nostalgic kind of bread brand out there. And just really interesting sort of combinations of like smoked pulled chicken covered with smoked garlic pork sausage. I mean, just all these things all together on buns and on plates. The taste is really fabulous. Now, I'll mention it's mostly a lunch place, mostly about lunch or to pick up a feed to bring home, or in the case of our travelers out there, for the cooler, for something to bring back home to wherever you're traveling to. And they do close early on most nights, 6 o'clock, but stay open a little bit later on the weekends if you're going to make a fun weekend of it out there in Lafayette.
Can you buy like a whole chicken or?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. When you go in, you'll see some people who are just there for lunch and others who are obviously stocking up for a big feed at home. So really what we have here, Johnson's Boucanière, it's a modern reengineering of a really old traditional Cajun country smokehouse with a long tradition to it. You see this in a lot of places, you know, and a lot all over the country, really. It's a trend. But when it happens in South Louisiana, it's going to be really fun and delicious.
Well, you have made me some hungry. Let's go.
Okay. I'm right behind you.
Okay. You ready to ramble?
Yeah, let's ramble on.
Thank you, Ian. Louisiana Eats ramblin' reporter, Ian McNulty. When Gulf waters begin to chill down in Louisiana, our state's oysters come into prime time. Those briny beauties are always heavenly on the half shell, slurped down with a cold beer at your favorite oyster bar. They're also readily available by the pint in most Louisiana grocery stores for cooking at home. Something to keep in mind when cooking already shucked oysters is that in the processing plant, they're likely to have been washed. As the shucker flips the oyster meat onto a fine mesh screen, an equally fine mist of water rinses the oyster clean of any bit of shell or dirt. But that shucked oyster has the ability to suck up some of that rinsing water, slightly reducing its intense saltiness and complicating the cooking process. When a washed oyster begins to cook, it will expel that extra water, making baked oyster dishes a little too juicy and thinning any sauce that they are added to raw. To avoid this trouble, poach the oysters before adding them to your favorite recipe. Pour the oysters and their liquid into a saucepan and place over a medium-high heat. Using your hand, gently stir the oysters until it gets too hot for your fingers in the pot. At that same time, it will be hot enough for the oyster to release that extra water. Remove the pot from the heat and drain off the liquid. You'll see a little ruffle along the oyster's edge to indicate that it's perfectly poached. It's oyster time in Louisiana, and our beautiful bivalves are some of my favorite Louisiana eats.
Yes, I found a lot of oysters these days. And with all comes a pearl and a pretty heart shell to break.
Fred Street's Hi-Hat Cafe has rapidly become a New Orleans hotspot. During the taping of this season's HBO series Treme, owner Chip Apperson and his chef Jeremy Walgamott got the surprise of a lifetime when some of the biggest names of the food world all convened on that casual little uptown eatery for a Sunday supper. Chip and Jeremy, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So tell me, out of all of the eateries in New Orleans, how in the world do you think they picked Hi-Hat?
Well, I'm pretty sure we have Lola's Eli to thank for that. He'd been a customer and a friend of the restaurant since we opened, and he writes for the series. And they were looking for a place to go that these guys were not going to be able to experience in their normal everyday life. They weren't going to take them to a fancy white tablecloth restaurant because that's what they do and get in life every day. And thanks to Lola's, they came to see us, and it was quite nice.
So give us the scoop. How did that night come about?
We got a call from somebody that said that they were from the Treme office here in New Orleans. It said that they wanted to bring some of their staff and some people in, and they told us, thank goodness, that it was going to be some of the chefs that play themselves in one of the many storylines in Treme.
So who arrived?
They told us Tom Colicchio was coming, David Chang, Wiley Dufresne, Alfred Portale, and Eric Repair.
So for
last but not least, Eric Repair.
And for our listeners who might not be familiar with those names, tie them together with restaurants and such.
Wiley Dufresne has a restaurant called WD50 in New York. It's sort of a molecular gastronomy sort of a place. He really takes apart food and re-puts it together in some fun ways. David Chang has several different restaurants now, and all under the Momofuku banner. And they do sort of a Korean-French fusion. Tom Colicchio is obviously the chef that is one of the main guys on Top Chef, and he was the chef at Kraft, a steakhouse. And he does a lot of American food. Eric Repair is probably the best guy to ever talk to about fish anywhere in the world. He's kind of a food god
in his own way.
Absolutely. He has the restaurant La Bernardin in New York, which I believe has 3 Michelin stars. And, I mean, he's been doing it for forever. Alfred Portale is actually sort of the older guy in the group. And I know that he trained several of the guys that came with. And he has a restaurant called Gotham Bar and Grill, which is one of the older, more established restaurants in New York City.
So you got this reservation. Were you buying that story?
Truthfully, in the beginning, we thought it was somebody was punking us a little bit. but they called back and confirmed. They called back and increased the number of the reservation. We figured out it was a real deal. But
nobody believed it right at first. We all thought somebody was just messing with us.
Yeah.
And how are you feeling about this, Jeremy? I mean, when you learned who you were going to cook for, did you get butterflies?
I did. It was nerve-wracking. I told all the guys in the kitchen, obviously, and I personally have most of their cookbooks in my house, and you know everybody reads about them, and these are the guys that we sort of see on TV, and we read in food reviews, and we're constantly thinking, oh, I'd love to go to their restaurant, and to have them come to our restaurant was crazy. And we all couldn't, it took a little while to wrap our heads around the fact that they were going to be there, so we actually had almost double the kitchen staff that we have on a normal Sunday night. working that Sunday night because everybody wanted to cook for these guys.
So did you plan something special or were you just planning on rolling out the hi-hat menu?
We were chatting just planning on doing the regular menu. We did have the special be stewed chicken, which is a special we do on a regular basis, but we made it a point to do it for that night because we wanted to serve these guys the stewed chicken with the spoon bread and mustard greens.
And so what happens when they hit the door?
It was very surreal. David Simon and some of his crew got there early, and then one of those big 15-passenger vans pulled up and, you know, bang, 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 just one after another got out and started walking to the front door. It was really surreal. And they came in, introduced everybody. It was a nice hello, and everybody kind of crowded around the bar for a while and had some cocktails. And our idea was to put out some tamales and some pimento cheese and some boudin and stuff on the table and let them kind of go through that. And then we were going to give everybody menus and tell them about specials, and then they were just going to order off the menu. So we couldn't get them to sit down, and David Simon finally said, "Chip, just go ahead and put some food on the table, and that maybe that'll encourage everybody to sit down, because everybody's sitting around the bar cocktailing and having a good time." So we did that, and I think Tom Colicchio goes, "Well, I guess they want us to sit down now." So they all sat down. They started eating and passing stuff around family style and having a, I mean, really, it seemed like they were enjoying themselves. And all those guys have a good camaraderie and have known each other for years. So it was cool to just observe all that going on. When those starters started to disappear, I went up to David Simon and I said, "Shall I pass out menus now?" And then again, Colicchio, who seemed to be feeling pretty good, said, "No, don't do that, Chip. Just keep doing what you're doing."
Just feed us.
Yeah, so we started sending food out, and everybody was enjoying stuff. We'd send out a couple plates here and a couple plates there, and we got really excited about it, and all the guys were super nice. I know that Wiley Dufresne knew that one of my cooks at the time was a big fan of his, so Wiley came up and started talking to him and said, "I want you to make me this, and I want you to make me this," and my cook was just standing there like a deer in the headlights. yes, chef, anything you want.
And what was going on in the rest of the dining room when this is going on? Were there other diners there that night?
Yeah, we had a busy night, and some customers knew the faces coming in the door and were kind of like looking at me going, "What's going on?" Coincidentally, a friend and colleague from Memphis was in town catering a wedding, and I didn't tell her what was going on because I didn't know if it was going to blow up at the last minute. But I looked over at her face as she was watching who was coming in the front door, and she looked at me, and it was just like, "What is going on here?" It was fun. It was very cool.
So it happens. You got this thrilling time. How does it all wind down?
Probably the snapshot that will remain forever in my head is one of Eric Repair eating Jeremy's barbecue shrimp with his fingers, washing it down with some good single barrel bourbon. You know, here's the chef of arguably one of the best seafood restaurants, fish restaurants in the world, sitting in our place in his cashmere turtleneck with his scarf thrown across his shoulder, eating with his fingers and laughing and enjoying himself. It was pretty exciting.
All the guys in the kitchen really wanted a picture with all the chefs. So Chip was nice enough to go out there when I asked him to, and very casually asked the chefs if they would mind having a picture with all the guys in the kitchen. They were all nice enough to oblige, and I think they were pretty happy about it.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for coming to tell us this enticing story. And next time this happens, would you call me, guys? I'm just a few blocks down the street, you know.
You're on my speed dial.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Chip Epperson and Chef Jeremy Walgamott of Ferret Street's Hi-Hat Cafe. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lightseekin Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording.
Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh, our editors Zoe Sullivan and Lane Kaplan Levinson, and our hardworking intern, Lauren Menking. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.